Lecture 12, Naval Warfare and the Battle of Salamis.
Our focus thus far has been exclusively on land warfare. Now it is time to broaden our horizons to include naval operations. We first survey early developments, then examine the revolution initiated by the introduction of the ship called the Trireme, and then turn our attention to the Battle of Salamis, the next big clash in Xerxes' invasion of Greece. Naval warfare had been a part of military operations from early in the history of the Mediterranean basin. The Egyptians conducted naval operations, though not on a huge scale. The Old Kingdom inscription on the tomb of Weni, which we examined in Lecture 4, record a joint land-sea assault on the Asiatic sand dwellers, so-called. "I crossed over in transports with these troops," he says. "I made a landing at the rear of the heights of the mountain range on the north of the land of the sand dwellers." But it appears that the ships here were deployed as adjuncts to a land campaign rather than fighting at sea. Similarly, Ramesses III's great fights with the sea peoples in the early 12th century BC occurred in the Nile Delta and took place partly on land, partly on the river, and partly at sea. Reliefs show curved boats which, if shown to scale, are rather small and carry both missile troops and shielded spearmen. The fighting seems to be limited to combat on deck. Ramming is not depicted. So far as we can tell, then, Egyptian naval capabilities were fairly limited. The Egyptians are not known to have launched major naval or seaborne campaigns at any time in their independent history. Ships, therefore, appear to have played mainly a delivery and support role in land operations. The situation was similar in the Near East until the Iron Age. Naval warfare was only minimally practiced, but after about 1000 BC, the Phoenicians, inhabitants of modern-day Lebanon, were regarded as the regional masters of the art. The Assyrians used boats and ships in campaigns in riverlands and in marshy regions. Reliefs show fighting from reed boats in marshes, the transportation of chariots across rivers in what looked like coracles, and Assyrian troops crossing rivers by swimming on inflated animal skins. As with Egypt, these are all support actions for land operations. Yet, the palace of Sennacherib at Nineveh has yielded a relief of about 700 BC in date, which depicts what is probably a Phoenician warship. It has a rowing crew on two levels, so it's a so-called bireme, who are shown inside the ship. A top deck has round shields as sort of a wall around the edge and is manned by a crew armed with bows and arrows. Only two of these can be seen since the relief is broken and the rest are lost. Most importantly, however, it has a ramming beak at the front. The addition of ramming beaks to ships changed them from mere fighting platforms into weapons unto themselves. Use of rams required the proper training of crews, demanded more sophisticated manoeuvring capabilities, and led to the development of set-piece manoeuvres. How all this was used by the Assyrians is not obvious. Their transmarine imperial holdings appear limited to the island of Cyprus, and that is more likely a claimed suzerainty than any reality. So despite their access to Phoenician ships, the Assyrians did not develop their naval capabilities to any great extent and remained a land power. The Persians reversed this tendency. They deployed Phoenician and Egyptian and Ionian Greek fleets in the Aegean and used them to attack Greek islands and, as we saw in Lecture 10, to deliver an invasion force across the Aegean to mainland Greece in 490 BC. In 480 BC, during Xerxes' invasion, their fleet acquitted itself quite well against the Greeks off the coast of Artemisium during the Thermopylae campaign. Their greatest test, however, was yet to come. Now, the Greeks themselves were a maritime people and were long accustomed to naval warfare. Wall paintings from the Bronze Age Cretan culture dubbed Minoan show ships and apparently a sea battle. A frieze from the so-called West House on Thera, dated to about 1500 BC, shows oared ships fitted out with bunting, perhaps involved in a regatta of some sort. One scene seems to show disembarked warriors attacking a coastal town and perhaps a naval engagement proper with sailors pitched into the sea, but this, it must be admitted, may also just be a storm wrecking the ships. It is largely agreed by scholars that the Mycenaeans from mainland Greece conquered Crete or parts of it around 1450 BC. If so, they must have arrived as seaborne invaders. And of course, remember that the traditions of the Trojan War have a large naval expedition to Asia at its core, even if the naval engagements themselves, or even if there were any, are not specifically described. The Homeric poems possibly reflecting here the situation in the 8th century BC, do refer to sea fights and the extra-large pikes used in them, even if no engagements are again specifically described. But raiding and piracy are part and parcel of the Homeric world, an accepted and acceptable mode of making a living. At one point, for instance, a host in the Odyssey asks his newly arrived visitors, "Where do you sail from over the running sea lanes? Out on some trading spree or roving the waves like pirates, sea wolves raiding at will who risk their lives to plunder other men?" Nearly contemporary Dipylon vases show beaked ships, which include scenes of disembarking warriors and, in one case, a sword fight underway on deck. What these scenes commemorate, actual events from real life or scenes inspired by the Homeric tradition, well, that's another matter. Toward the end of the 6th century, a new form of ship emerged that was to revolutionize naval warfare in the Mediterranean basin. This was the trireme. Up to this point, the ship of choice, among the Greeks anyway, had been the pentaconter, a 50-oar ship with a crew the same size. The trireme carried four times as many men. It was more than 120 feet long and a little over 20 feet wide. 170 crew members toiled on three banks of oars to propel the vessel at speeds of up to 9 knots, as was established by sea trials conducted on the replica trireme called the Olympias in the 1980s and 1990s. The ship could cover about 130 sea miles in a single day. It appears to have been invented by the Persians, or probably the Phoenicians, but was enthusiastically adopted by the Greeks, and by 500 BC it was already ubiquitous in Greek lands. As a warship, the trireme combined speed, maneuverability, and strength. Its on-deck armaments were minimal, usually a contingent of 4 archers and 10 hoplite marines. The focus, rather, was on ramming with bronze beaks, sometimes fitted with several blades. A fine example of one, by the way, has been found off the coast of Israel at a place called Athlit in 1980 and can be seen today in the museum at Haifa, dates to the Hellenistic era. The Greeks developed, or at least adopted from the Persians, several maneuvers that optimized the trireme's advantages. The dieplus, meaning a sailing through and out, saw attacking triremes pass between enemy ships and then wheel around and ram them from the sides or from the rear. The periplus, meaning a sailing around, may have been a phase of the dieplus or some sort of encircling maneuver in its own right. A defensive posture against both moves was the kuklos, or the circle, with the prows all facing outwards. The Greeks, in fact, we are told, adopted this formation when fighting the Persians at Artemisium. The trireme then revolutionized naval combat, which became much more sophisticated and was conducted on a far larger scale than the raids of the sea wolves referred to in Homer. The development of a substantial Persian royal navy in the Aegean, as well as ongoing local Greek rivalries, forced many Greek city-states with maritime interests to look to their ships in the late 6th and early 5th centuries BC. None did so more than Athens, as we saw last time how Themistocles persuaded the Athenians to double their navy's size between 490 and 480 BC. As a result, Athens commanded the largest and most modern fleet in Greek lands, followed by Corinth, and then behind them Corcyra, which is the modern island of Corfu. After the Persian Wars, the Athenians used their fleet to exert undue influence over the affairs of the Greek islands and the Aegean coastal regions. Naval power had come to define the polis, or city-state, of Athens. It is often argued that the turn to naval power had major ramifications on the domestic front inside Athens. Rowers were drawn from the lower orders, the ones usually excluded from muster since they could not afford the expense of hoplite equipment. But the manpower requirements of a trireme, 40,000 alone for Athens's 200 triremes, if all fully crewed and all in service at once, meant that these poor Athenians now played a vital military role and so enjoyed unprecedented political leverage in the democratic assembly. This, in any case, is the view of the pamphleteer called the Old Oligarch, who is judged to have lived sometime towards the end of the 5th century BC and is a strong critic of the Athenian democracy, hence his name, the Old Oligarch. We don't actually know what his name was, but that's the name given to him by modern scholars. His views, by the way, are echoed in the 4th century by Aristotle, who was no friend of democracy. The Old Oligarch's critique has been used to argue that naval power and democracy were inherently linked at Athens, the former undergirding the latter. This suggestion is not without its problems. First, it requires taking critics of Athenian democracy at their word. Study of how the Athenian navy was actually crewed and who rowed the ships does not support the proposal. So great was Athens's need for rowers that demand far outstripped supply. Many rowers were hired from abroad, drawn from the non-citizen resident population of Athens, or they were slaves. None of these groups, of course, enjoyed political rights in Athens. The percentage of lower-class Athenian citizens, then, who consistently served in the navy may well have been rather small. Without naval service, their alleged political clout dissipates. In any event, other powerful Greek naval states, Syracuse, Corinth, or Corcyra, were not democracies. The supposed inherent connection between naval power and democracy in Athens may well be a figment of the old oligarch's polemic. With the background duly filled in, let's return to the desperate situation facing the Greek alliance after Thermopylae. Athens, as we've seen, had been evacuated. The city was then captured by the Persians, plundered, and burned. Only some diehards held out on the Acropolis, convinced that the wooden wall mentioned in the Delphic oracle was to be taken literally. So they barricaded themselves in behind a wooden wall on the Acropolis, which was promptly burned down by the Persians. Meanwhile, the Allied fleet gathered in the Straits of Salamis off the south coast of Attica. It numbered between 320 and 378 triremes, depending on which source one reads. Of these, 180 were Athenian ships. The size of the Persian fleet is harder to estimate, but it must have been huge. Aeschylus, in his play The Persians, which was composed within a decade of the Battle of Salamis, puts it at an even 1,000 ships, surely a poetically handy figure. Herodotus has 1,207 Persian ships before Artemisium, as we saw last time, and with a few hundred lost to the fighting at Artemisium and some severe storms right before Salamis, we may imagine somewhat less than that. Modern estimates vary wildly and depend on the degree of the scholar's trust in the ancient authors. But the Greeks insisted that they were vastly outnumbered at Salamis, so a figure of 600 to 800 Persian warships, each with a crew of about 200, would not be impossible. In the crisis, strategic fault lines yawned open between the Peloponnesians and the Athenians. The Peloponnesians wished to build a wall across the isthmus of Corinth and defend their peninsula by land, while the fleet anchored off the coast. To be fair, the three naval engagements at Artemisium during the Thermopylae campaign did not offer much cause for hope. The sea fights had all been stalemates. Further, should the naval battle at Salamis go badly, the Peloponnesian coast would be virtually defenseless. The mood was therefore for withdrawal. Themistocles was convinced that should the fleet move to the isthmus, it would disperse as each contingent looked to its own interests. They must stay and fight in the strait at Salamis. He prevailed on Eurybiades, the Spartan commander-in-chief, to hold another meeting. First, he tried arguments based on strategy. The heavier Greek ships would have an advantage over the more numerous and lighter Persian vessels in the straits, he argued. But the Peloponnesians, chiefly led by the Corinthians, were not convinced. So Themistocles threatened a unilateral Athenian withdrawal from the entire war. They would make a new home for themselves in Italy. This worked. Eurybiades agreed to stay at Salamis. Themistocles, however, had no faith in his compatriot's constancy, so he sent a false message over to Xerxes. He reported that the Greeks were intent on escaping at the other end of the strait, and that Xerxes should act to prevent them from doing so. Xerxes took the bait and sent some 200 ships from Egypt around the island of Salamis to block the northern entrance of the straits. The Greeks were now trapped and had no choice but to fight. Themistocles, by threats and deceit, had manufactured a confrontation in the straits at Salamis. This whole account, as we have it in Herodotus, is seriously flawed. We have to accept the following. The Greek command at Salamis started debating whether to fight or to cut and run before the Persians even reached Athens. They were still debating this issue when word was brought that the Acropolis had fallen. But Herodotus elsewhere reports that the Acropolis held out for some time. The debate seems unduly protracted. Next, another assembly was called on the following day to discuss the same issue again. Stay and fight or withdraw to the isthmus. It is during this debate that Themistocles sends his false message to Xerxes. On the third day, when the Greeks were informed that they had been blocked into the straits, they are still in assembly and still debating the same issue. The account borders on the incoherent. There can be little doubt that strategic and tactical debates took place on both sides before so vital an engagement, but we can't accept Herodotus's illogical account of their content without serious caution. In all likelihood, he jerry-rigged his version from diverse sources who provided different anecdotes and details that he tried to string together into a coherent narrative. He failed. The defective and patchy source material makes tracing the battle's course equally difficult. The Persian fleet was made up of Phoenician and Ionian Greek ships, and having bottled up the Greeks in the straits, it approached from the wider southeastern end. Herodotus says that the Greeks were dismayed at the armada's size and, on its approach, began to backwater until one ship, claimed by both Athens and the island of Aegina, charged the Persian line, changed the course of the fighting, and led to the defeat of the Persians. This incident is suspiciously dramatic. After this, Herodotus' account devolves into a catalogue of individual exploits and stories, which makes a tactical assessment of the fighting all but impossible. Other sources provide some additional details, but little by way of a wider perspective on the engagement. One of the major problems is the initial deployment of the fleets in the straits. Herodotus envisioned the fleets lined up parallel to the shores on either side of the straits. The Persians lined up parallel to the Attic coast, with the Phoenicians on their right toward Eleusis, as he has it, and the Ionian ships on the left. The Greeks would then be opposite, parallel to the shore of Salamis. Now, such a disposition makes no sense. How could one fleet file past the other in column, its ship's sides exposed to ramming, without risking disaster? Much more likely is that the Greek fleet spanned the strait, facing southeast, and the Persians entered from the southeast, the fleet splitting to pass around an island at the narrow's entrance. The engagement then took place in the middle of the straits, and on this island, as the Greeks wrested it from Persian control. Although the tactical phases of the battle are lost to us, it emerges clearly that the Persian defeat was due to their numbers and the confusion in their ranks as their armada became compressed in the strait, while the Greeks kept their good order. Despite several modern attempts to identify complex tactical maneuvers during the battle, there's no solid evidence to suggest that they actually took place. The Greeks won by keeping their cool and making the most of the confusion among their enemy. Such is a perennial recipe for success in battle. The human cost of Salamis was huge. Ancient naval warfare, with its combination of ramming, missile exchanges, deck fighting, and the threat of drowning, was particularly lethal. For the rowers in the immediate vicinity of an enemy ram crashing into their ship, death would come by mashing or splinter wounds. If a ship sank, there would be a panic scramble to reach the deck, where missiles or enemy soldiers were waiting. Herodotus says that the Persian crews could not swim, so most were doomed as soon as their ship was holed. Even for those who survived a sinking, it was standard practice to shoot at survivors and hit them with oars and weapons in the sea. If any Persian survivors washed up onto the shores of the island of Salamis, Athenian ground troops waited them. And likewise, for any Greeks who made it to the Persian-occupied mainland, where Persian ground troops would have killed them off. All in all, the scene in the Straits of Salamis by battle's end would have been one of horrific carnage, wreckage and corpses littering the narrow patch of contested sea. The scene is vividly evoked by Aeschylus in his play The Persians, as a Persian messenger brings word of Salamis to the court back home. The hulls of our vessels rolled over, and the sea was hidden from our sight, strewn as it was with wrecks and slaughtered men. The shores and reefs were crowded with our dead. But as if our men were tunnies or a haul of fish, the foe kept striking and hacking them with broken oars and fragments of wrecked ships, and groans and shrieks together filled the open sea until the face of sable night hid the scene. Curiously, Herodotus does not record losses. Diodorus Siculus says that the Greeks lost 40 ships, the Persians 200, not including those captured. If these figures are right, then the Persians lost between 25% and 30% of their naval fighting force that day. It was a crushing defeat. Since, as we've seen, Herodotus states that the Persian crews could not swim, we may be looking at up to 40,000 men floundering in the strait, a good proportion of whom would have perished. Xerxes, who had watched proceedings from a throne set up on the nearby hill, was shaken. Our Greek sources think of him as fleeing home in a panic, but he had good reason to return to Asia. A victorious Greek fleet could have sailed to the Hellespont and, by smashing the pontoon bridge there, cut him off from home. This course of action was actually proposed, but rejected by the Greek command. Also, a Persian king defeated in distant lands was, by Persian standards, a fruit ripe for the plucking. ambitions lurking in the hearts of royal relatives might be stirred by such news. Xerxes had to get back to Asia. The importance of Salamis is not to be doubted, but it has been overstated in certain quarters. Victor Davis Hanson, in his account of the battle in his book Carnage and Culture, credits the outcome of Salamis to the Greek devotion to freedom, a concept absent from Persian political culture. The Greeks fought more ferociously at Salamis because they were free men. The Persians were the slaves of a despot. In particular, he singles out the importance of free speech in the Greek pre-battle debates, of which he writes, and I quote, "The freedom to explore different strategies, debate tactics, and listen to the complaints of the sailors was raucous and not pretty, but when the battle itself got underway, the Greeks, not the Persians, had at last discovered the best way to fight in the Strait of Salamis," unquote. This interpretation, while cleverly argued and certainly appealing, does not jibe particularly well with known facts as far as I'm concerned. There's no compelling evidence from Salamis or indeed anywhere else that free people fight harder and more determinedly than conscripts in the service of autocrats. Some of the most feared and effective fighting forces in world history have been the Mongols, the Ottoman Janissaries, the Nazi Panzer Divisions, and the Red Army of the Second World War, all serving systems not notable for their devotion to individual liberty. As military historian John Lazenby succinctly puts it, war puts no premium on freedom. Also, as we saw earlier, Herodotus' account of the Greek debates before the battle borders on the incoherent. Even as presented, they were dominated by only one issue. Do we stay or do we go? There is no indication of prolonged discussion of specific tactical approaches for fighting in the Straits, outside of how such considerations impinged on that overarching question. In the end, the Greeks were threatened and tricked into fighting at Salamis by Themistocles. This is hardly a banner example of discovery through debate. As to the fighting at Salamis, we simply do not have enough detailed information to declare that the Greeks fought better because they were free men. Herodotus, in fact, documents two episodes of courage on the Persian side and two on the Greek. He also records the cowardice of the Corinthians on the Greek side, but recounts no corresponding example of cowardice on the Persian side. So, if anything, perhaps the edge goes to the Persians for having fought ferociously, even if they lost. On the surface, then, both sides fought equally hard at Salamis. But the Persians did so at a huge tactical disadvantage, with a much larger fleet compressed into the small straits. This latter fact, rather than the degree of freedom enjoyed by the combatants, is what determined the outcome at Salamis. As to the historical importance of Salamis, one assessment reads as follows. We would live under a much different tradition today, one where writers are under death sentences, women secluded and veiled, free speech curtailed, government in the hands of the autocrat's extended family, universities mere centres of religious zealotry, and the thought police in our living rooms and bedrooms, had Themistocles and his sailors failed. This sort of thing strikes me as rather overstated, even a little confused. It equates a rather tolerant ancient Persian Zoroastrianism with a less forgiving modern Islamic extremism. No doubt had the Greeks lost at Salamis, Western history would have been very different. But how different is impossible to say. Greeks were well ensconced in South Italy and Sicily. Survivors could have found refuges there and continued their traditions. Remember, Themistocles had said that if the fleet would not stay at Salamis, he would take the Athenians off to Italy. Well, survivors could have done that. So I really see no good reason to think that the defeat at Salamis would have heralded the end of Western civilization, although certainly that civilization would have looked rather different. In the context of the war in 480 BC, Salamis was definitely the decisive turning point. But there was more work to be done. A huge Persian land force was still on Greek soil, and it yet might secure the conquest of Greece for the great king. Despite Salamis, the Persians still entertained high hopes for victory. They were not unfounded. The enormous army under Mardonius wintered in central Greece over 480 into 479 BC. It was comprised of hand-picked troops, Persians, Medes, Sacae, and Ionian Greek hoplites. Herodotus numbers the host at 300,000 Persians and 50,000 Ionians. The numbers are, as usual, seriously exaggerated, but an army of even one-third the size would still be around 100,000 strong, and not untypical for a Persian royal host. If we imagine the initial invading force has been about 100,000 combatants, and having lost maybe 8,000 to 10,000 at Thermopylae, we're still looking at maybe 90,000 to 100,000. Using diplomacy and money to undermine Greek resistance was discussed by the Persian high command, but Mardonius rejected this softly approach. He wanted to settle the issue in battle. So the Persians moved into the open plains of Boeotia, where the cavalry could be cut loose, and set up camp on the Esopus River near Plataea. Mardonius had chosen his ground well. An allied Greek army was assembled, numbered by Herodotus at 110,000, drawn from 23 states. Of this force, 40,500 were hoplites, the rest light-armed. This was the largest hoplite army ever mustered. The most important Greek contingents were 10,000 Spartan hoplites under their king Pausanias and 8,000 Athenian hoplites under a guy called Aristides the Wise. The other Greek contingents, some as few as 200 strong, had their own commanders, but everyone recognized, of course, Pausanias the Spartan as the ranking officer. The Greek force occupied positions on the low hills and ridges facing the Persians across the Esopus. Some skirmishes ensued. According to Herodotus, in these engagements, the Persian cavalry charged the Greeks in squadrons, wheeled and turned. This makes it clear that the Persian cavalry relied first and foremost on missile weapons and that they were not heavy cavalry designed to charge en masse and break enemy ranks. The main bodies, however, occupying positions favorable to themselves and reluctant to surrender the advantage, did not engage for many days. The Greek army, in three main contingents, with the Athenians on the left, the Spartans on the right, and everybody else in the middle, moved about on its ridges. In the course of these maneuvers, the center, nearly 20,000 men strong, got lost in the dark and ended up almost 4 kilometers behind the front. Dawn broke on the Athenians and the Spartans widely separated. Seeing an opportunity, Mardonius pounced. The main brunt of the assault fell on the Spartans and their allies, probably numbering about 20,000 strong, both light-armed and hoplites. But the Persians lost cohesion in their advance. Rather like the Athenians at Marathon, the Spartans charged the Persian lines, smashed through their wall of wicker shields, and came to grips with the lightly armored Persian infantry. Marathon quickly repeated itself. The Persians fought tenaciously, but under the huge disadvantage of lack of armor and shorter spears. They also engaged the Spartans in small groups rather than en masse, and so effectively negated their numerical advantage. Not even breaking the Spartan spears gave them an edge. In this sort of messy, close-quarter combat, the Persians were no match for the Spartan hoplite, for whom this sort of thing was the norm. The fight was intense and protracted, and this is a testament to the fighting spirit of the Persian troops. They tried their best, but were outclassed. Mardonius and his cavalry fared no better than the infantry did, as is the case whenever cavalry confront infantry who maintain their good order. Not long into the fight, Mardonius was killed. Leaderless, Persian resistance disintegrated, and the battle phased into the slaughter of desperate and fleeing men. Meanwhile, the Athenians had set out to assist the Spartans in their crisis, but they were intercepted en route by the Ionian Greeks and endured a tough fight of their own, in which they eventually prevailed. The Greek center, far to the rear, tried to get in on the action, but it was caught in the open by Persian cavalry and suffered 600 casualties. Herodotus numbers the Greek casualties as 91 Spartans, 17 Tegeans, and 52 Athenians, as opposed to 257,000 Persians. These figures are, of course, nonsensical and make no mention of the 600 losses from the Greek center. Other sources, no less confused, speak of anywhere from 1,300 to 10,000 Greek dead. We will never know the exact figures, but ancient battles usually transmogrified into massacres once one side turned its back to flee. So a disproportion of casualties on the losing side is to be expected, though hardly on the scale stated in the figures given for Plataea. The Battle of Plataea cemented the victory at Salamis the previous year and freed Greece from the threat of Persian rule. On the same day as Plataea, a Greek army and fleet confronted the remnants of the Persian fleet from Salamis on a shoreside battle on the peninsula of Mycale on the Turkish coast. Here too, the Persians were routed. What was different about this fight, of course, was that it took place on Persian, not on Greek soil. The Greeks were taking the fight to the enemy. But in a great historical irony, the allied Greek assault on the Persians and those Greeks who had Medes during the Persian invasions ultimately led to a vast inter-Greek conflict. A conflict that was to break the back of Greek power and see Athens, the hero of Marathon and Salamis, laid low. The turning point in this, the Peloponnesian War, is the subject of our next lecture.